Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. Your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, July 8th, 2006. Our focus today, the week after July 4th, is on freedom in the U.S. and elsewhere. Here's what we have coming up for you. In our first hour, after the news, we'll bring you Media Minutes, focusing on the Freedom of Information Act, then Making Waves coverage of the Troops Home Fast demonstration this past week in Portsmouth. We'll then hear coverage of the D.C. version of the Troops Home Fast, a piece from the Rainforest Action Network on U.S. dependence on oil, and Jav Parrish on freedom of medical treatment. In our second hour, we'll hear a Making Waves interview of Malalai Joya, Afghan legislator, on her country's attempts to establish a free and open democracy. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. First, for some news you need to know. Today, the show after July 4th, we start with a few stories along the theme of freedom in the United States. This from WMUR Channel 9 New Hampshire's website. Soldier's widow takes fight for Wiccan symbol to Washington. July 5th, 2006. The widow of a U.S. soldier killed in Afghanistan is appealing the government's refusal to put a Wiccan symbol on his memorial plaque. Roberta Stort is to meet Wednesday with an undersecretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs and is threatening to sue unless her demand is met. Her husband, Nevada Army National Guard Sergeant Patrick Stort, died September 25th when his helicopter was shot down. Four others also died. The agency so far has refused to grant the family's request to have the Wiccan Pentacle, a five-pointed star surrounded by a circle, placed on Stort's government-issued plaque at the Northern Nevada Veterans Memorial Cemetery. Wicca is not among the 38 belief systems, including atheism, recognized by the department. From Newsday on July 4th. Compromise allows signs on Iraq War at July 4th parade. Marchers in Southampton, New York's 4th of July parade will be able to carry signs reading, "Support our troops, bring them home now," according to a compromise decision hammered out Monday among the village, the marchers, and a federal judge. After complaints about those signs last year, the village's parade committee ruled that no political propaganda or advertising could be carried by marchers, and that signs should only reflect the themes of the parade, "Let freedom ring" and "Support our troops." Mayor Mark Epley said Monday night that the village never intended to muzzle free speech, and that the marchers who took Southampton to court were never expressly told they could not march. Still, members of the Unitarian Universalist Church in Bridgehampton, who wanted to carry the signs, said they never received permission to march. The federal court ruling Monday allows them to march and carry signs. James Henry, attorney for the church, responded to the decision, saying, "Can you imagine a court order that tells people they have the right to engage in free speech on the 4th of July, and signed by a federal judge?" Now for a press release from thankyoult.org. Army charges Lieutenant Watada with contempt towards President, faces over 7 years military prison. On July 5th, U.S. Army First Lieutenant Aaron K. Watada, the first commissioned officer to publicly refuse deployment to the Iraq War and Occupation, was formally charged with three articles of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Two counts of contempt towards officials, Article 88, specifically President G.W. Bush, three counts of conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman, and one count of missing movement. If convicted of all six charges by a general court-martial, Lieutenant Watada could be sentenced to over 7 years in a military prison. Lieutenant Watada's lawyer, Eric Seitz, said, We expected the missing movement charge, but we are somewhat astounded by the contempt and conduct unbecoming charges. These additional charges open up the substance of Lieutenant Watada's statements for review and raise important First Amendment issues. We are delighted that the Army has given us the opportunity to litigate these questions. Most previous prosecutions of Article 88 took place during the Civil War and World War I, and the last known prosecution was in 1965, Howe v. U.S., when Lieutenant Henry Howe protested U.S. foreign policy during the Vietnam War. Even before Lieutenant Watada refused to ship out to Iraq on June 22nd, the Army was focusing their investigation on his speech. The formal charges confirm that the Army's primary objective is silencing Lieutenant Watada's dissent. And now for some international news. From the Al Jazeera website on July 2nd, 2006. Israeli rally opposes Gaza offensive. Hundreds of protesters gathered outside the Israeli Prime Minister's home on Saturday night to denounce the government as war criminals and demand an end to the Gaza invasion. Demonstrators stood outside Ehud Olmert's official residence in Jerusalem, holding banners that read, "Stop! War crimes ahead!" and "Swap hostages now!" The protest follows smaller actions on the same theme in the past few days at the Sufa Army base near the southern Gaza border and outside the Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv. The Saturday demonstration was organized by Yesh Gavol, the peace movement that supports refusal to serve in the Israeli army. Yishai Menuhin, a spokesman for Yesh Gavol, said, "We call for our government to stop targeting Palestinian civilians. The targeting of civilians is a war crime. And start negotiating with the elected Palestinian leaders, not to arrest them." Aviv Sela, a 19-year-old who has been jailed for refusing to serve in the army, said at the protest, "The military solution is not a solution." He added that, while not everyone is prepared to go to prison, everyone has the strength to say no to the attack in Gaza. Other demonstrators chanted, "The occupation is terror, the refuser is a hero." Within Israel, the Gaza invasion is being portrayed as an attempt to release an Israeli hostage, 19-year-old Corporal Gilad Shalit. Tamar Gozansky, a former Knesset member, said on Saturday night, "The soldier is not a hostage. He is a prisoner of war. Israel is holding about 7,000 Palestinian prisoners in jail." Demonstrators believe that the Gaza invasion had little to do with the kidnapped soldier. Zvi Schuldiner, who attended the protest, said, "It is not self-defense, and it is not new. Israel has been dropping artillery shells on Gaza and attacking the population for months." Veteran peace activist Yuri Avneri said, "People have been in the army and know the difference between acts of terrorism and this classic and very daring commando act of fighters against soldiers." Commentators on the left say that the wider Israeli public is critical of the Gaza invasion, not least because there is little trust for the leadership of Olmert and the defense minister Amir Peretz. Avneri said, "There is a growing doubt about it. The gap between what the government says and what logic says is getting bigger from day to day." A recent poll in the newspaper Yediot Aharonot shows 58% in favor of a prisoner swap to release Shalit. And now for Media Minutes, to look at some news relating to media issues.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The Freedom of Information Act turned 40 on July 4th, and just in time, the federal government launches a project to examine ways to thwart it. Scholars at St. Mary's University School of Law in San Antonio, Texas, are being paid $1 million to analyze various federal and state secrecy laws, with the goal of devising a unified statute that makes it easier for government to restrict access to information, some of which may now be publicly available. This research project is being overseen by the U.S. Air Force, and in a note of historical irony, one of the original congressional co-sponsors of the Freedom of Information Act was none other than the current Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, a former representative from Illinois. Meanwhile, it's getting harder to successfully use the Freedom of Information Act. A report from the Coalition of Journalists for an Open Government says nearly one out of every three FOIA requests filed with federal agencies last year is stuck in some sort of bureaucratic quicksand. You've got a better than even chance of prying loose government information via the Freedom of Information Act, but if you challenge a denial in court, the government's got better than even odds of winning that case.
The Big Brother building process continues apace in America. Since 2004, some 52 federal government agencies have gotten involved in the practice of purchasing personal information on American citizens from private data mining companies. These companies collect information on people, largely through consumer purchases and subscriptions, and aggregate this information into a single database, which can then be analyzed for patterns. There's no definitive record of just how much money is being spent on such activity, nor is it clear how data mining is actually being used by the government. Meanwhile, the Justice Department is quietly meeting with executives from major phone, cable, and internet content companies and requesting that they save information on those who use their services for up to 2 years, all in the name of fighting terrorism and child pornography. What most interests federal officials are web searches and email records.
Does the most powerful man in the United States Senate on issues involving telecommunication and media even know what the internet is? In a recent hearing on major legislation rewriting whole sections of federal telecom law, Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, the Republican chairman of the Senate's Commerce Committee, the main gatekeeper for any internet-related legislation, argued passionately both for and against the principle of network neutrality, all in the same speech. In a screed that clocked in over 10 minutes, Stevens, who earlier this year expressed a belief that analog and digital people exist, described the internet as a, quote, messaging service that is, quote, essential to the operation of families. He was probably talking about email, but in the mind of Senator Stevens, one email may very well contain the informational universe.
I just the other day got internet was sent by my staff at 10 o'clock in the morning on Friday. I got it yesterday. Why? Because it got tangled up with all these things that are going on the internet commercially.
While Stevens argued vehemently against carving the internet up into tiers of service where the potential for democratic communication is done away with in exchange for a system where your ability to speak is determined by how much you're willing to pay for the privilege, the bill he's sponsoring contains no provisions prohibiting such data discrimination. Near the end of his tirade, Stevens made analogy reality, taking folks like AT&T's CEO Ed Whitaker literally when they talk about their pipes. The senator actually seems to believe that the internet's just another form of plumbing.
The internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes. And if you don't understand, those tubes can be filled. And if they're filled, when you put your message in, it gets in line. It's going to be delayed by anyone that puts into that tube enormous amounts of material. Enormous amounts of material.
Not only is the internet not a series of tubes, online information is not crammed into a single package and shoved off to its destination like a parcel going through the mail. Information is broken up into packets, which can take many different routes to the same end point. And the internet is far from being clogged with information. Many of the most advanced fiber optic networks operate at just a fraction of their capacity to handle data. Stevens has raked in more than $70,000 in direct campaign donations from the major phone and cable companies in the 2006 election cycle. That's impressive, especially when you consider that he's not up for re-election until 2008. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
You're listening to Making Waves. We'll be bringing you coverage from the troops' home fast actions, both in Portsmouth and then in D.C., after this song by Ryan Harvey called It's Bigger Than a War.
It's bigger than a war. border. That's to say the least. It traverses over borders through lines of the police. It's bigger than the oil, it's a military dream. It's politicians propping up another sick regime. Now the people are against it till they show it in the streets. They're met with tons of tear, got some fake Osama tapes. The bigger that they grow, the harder it will get. Their pockets fill up further with every terror threat. Snowy light on our stomachs playing into the charade. Lifting glasses in a toast to every bombing raid. It's bigger than a war. It's bigger than a war. It's bigger than a war, it's an economic game. A battle for the power, wealth, and the atomic gain. It's a private profit mission for the elite few. It's clearer than the lights so we can see right through. And turn we riot in the streets and shut the city down. When they meet inside their fortress walls, we try to tear them down. Police bring the cannons out to keep the war going. Throwing guns onto the people with the prisons overflowing. The poor housing ghetto so they cannot stand a chance. Your vote doesn't count unless you buy it in advance. It's bigger than a war. It's bigger than a war. Bigger than a war by a striking height. You can smell it in the air in the dead of night. It's coming through the screen of the TV news. When they fill your head with lies, try to change your views. The same corporations that make the weaponry are telling you what matters and what you need to believe. While they profit from the deaths of the young lion dead, sticking money in the pockets of some lion fed. The starving in this place can rot away. Another child's mother was shot today. It's bigger than a war. It's bigger than a war. Bigger than a war, it's the whole damn plan. Vietnam, Los, Indonesia, Iraq, Afghanistan. Let the truth be told, they ain't in it for the people. It's a matter of protection for the pocket or the steeple. Don't be fooled by their words or their remedies. Send your kids to die in battle while they train their enemies. Open markets, open fire, it's the same thing. Forcing poverty upon us in the interest of the king. Let it be known forever that this world is free. Stand up and fight back at those who take that right away. It's bigger than a war. It's bigger than a war. Bigger than a war, it's a day-to-day. Capitalism's price to pay. It's a system based on murder and the packaging of fear. Swallowing of lies and the cranking of the gears. They need us, we don't need them. 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 They would have us work in the prison yard. Train one of us to be the prison guard. And we fight amongst each other as we grow paranoid. With the heroin and television, there will fill the void. But freedom lives forever and our aim is true. The answer lives inside of you. It's bigger than a war. It's bigger than a war. It's bigger than a war. It's bigger than a war.
That was Ryan Harvey with It's Bigger Than a War. We now bring you Making Waves exclusive coverage of the Troops Home Fast action in Portsmouth Market Square this past July 4th. This is Amy Antonucci for Making Waves. It's July 4th, 2006, midday, and I am in Portsmouth Market Square. Today, between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m., there is a Troops Home Fast happening here downtown, and we are going to find out a little more about it. First, we're going to speak with Pat Galloway, one of the main organizers for the event. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you.
Can you tell us more about the event and why it's happening?
Yeah, we've come out in solidarity with Cindy Sheehan and others from Code Pink, who are staging a national hunger strike in an effort to call attention to all of our troops in Iraq who are not here on this 4th of July enjoying barbecue with their friends and family. And to honor them, we are fasting, not enjoying barbecue with our families and friends, to stand in solidarity with those in Iraq and those nationally who are trying to bring them home.
So you mentioned Cindy Sheehan and Code Pink. Who else is involved in putting this on and participating in it?
Well, there are individuals all across the country and well-known people such as Susan Sarandon, Willie Nelson, Danny Glover, Dick Gregory, and many military veterans, religious leaders, students and women's groups. Diane Wilson, who has engaged in several other hunger strikes in her history as an environmental activist, says that her goal is to bring the troops home, and she's going to fast as long as she can in that effort. Some people are doing rolling fasts in which someone will fast for 24 hours and they'll go to the next person and they'll fast for 24 hours and they intend to continue this on until September 21st, which is International Peace Day. And at that time, if the troops are not home, They'll engage in direct action, civil disobedience, in order to make their voices heard more. Also, the troops in Iraq, once you've enlisted, you're not allowed to voice dissension. You're not allowed to express your opinion about whether you feel you're there legitimately or not. And we're here to try to give them a voice, those who find themselves there and are struggling.
Thanks. So we're talking to a few other people, hearing why others have chosen to come out and participate in the fast. Would you like to tell us your name, sir?
Yeah, hi, my name's Bob Moore. I'm from East Kingston, New Hampshire. And I caught wind of this vigil today on David Diamond's mailing list. SECO's Peace Response agreed to represent their end in this effort to bring the troops home. Since I had the day to be able to express my views on this and to show my support for bringing the troops home, trying to create peace rather than violent ways of trying to solve problems, this is the reason that I've come down. It's just to support that effort. I think it's a very good, wise move. I like Cindy Sheehan's work, the kind of work that she's been doing, very in support of that.
And you're fasting today?
I am fasting today, yes. I thought that was also honorable. One of my heroes is Gandhi, and I appreciated the work that he could do using a means of fasting and a means of nonviolent civil disobedience or nonviolent ways of trying to make things happen, turn things around.
So what is your hope around the war? I know that the Troops Home Fast Coalition is calling for an exit strategy in September. Do you share that wish?
Yes, I am. I'm in support of that. I think that the sooner that they can get them home, the better. I'm very upset at the toll that it's taking on our forces, as well as the human tragedy that's taking place in Iraq. It affects me deeply. I just hate to see the daily toll that's taking. And I think that, unfortunately, our presence there, I think, is actually creating animosity. And as long as our presence are there, I think that this is no solution, really, to a problem. I wish the problem was avoided, to be honest with you. But since there is a problem here, which appears to be chronic, I think the sooner that the troops can come home, the better.
Thanks. Also here, participating in yet another vigil, is Edith Pearson from Maine. Edith, can you tell us why you chose to come out today?
I want to stand and speak for peace with other people any special day, particularly the 4th of July.
Why the 4th of July?
Well, the 4th of July was our Independence Day. Unfortunately, we had to fight a war to get there. I don't believe that the war we're fighting now is comparable to the war that we fought for independence.
Thanks. You're welcome. And what is your name?
I'm Wes Flurrell. I'm a Vietnam vet and I've been involved in the Seacoast response to the invasion of Iraq, and I was involved back in Cambridge 20, 30 years ago. This event is in response to a national effort and a statewide effort with a fast leading up to a September protest event. And I think a fast is a typical form of protest. I think one of the organizers' comments was to try to do a little more, step it up to get Congress and hopefully the administration to pay some attention, because they haven't been paying much attention to date. And I think it was just published in the papers recently, and now a majority of the public think the invasion of Iraq's a mistake.
What are your biggest concerns? What brings you here?
I think the biggest concern is the lack of the response of the government to the feelings of the public. The lack of response of the government to some of their own initial papers saying it was a mistake, and the Pentagon saying it was a mistake, and that basically being squashed by the administration and doing what they felt they wanted to do or needed to do, and it's proven to be an error.
I see you're wearing your Vietnam Veterans Against the War shirt. What do you think you bring to protest and to your participation as a veteran that's different from other people?
I think a lot of people see once a veteran, always a veteran. Always support what the administration does without questioning it. And I think the Veterans for Peace and the Vietnam Veterans Against the War both demonstrate that there are people that rethink what goes on. People that have experienced war firsthand recognize it's not the glossy hype from the enlistment people, that it's really a devastation of the country that gets invaded.
And now I understand there's an Iraq Veterans Against War that's formed.
That's correct. We've had a couple members join us. Some of them are on active duty, which makes it very difficult to get free and also could lead to demotion or other problems for them. I don't know where their headquarters is, but have seen a few, and Vietnam Veterans for Peace and the Veterans for Peace both are encouraging them to join in the overall activities.
Great, thanks. Let's talk with some people who are not part of the action, but are hanging out here in the square today. So, you all, I see, have been here a while observing, at least, the Fasters. Any thoughts on what they're doing?
Well, my personal opinion, I would like to see, our family come back. I don't think it's right that they're over there, personally. That's just my personal opinion. I mean, I've been living here in Portsmouth forever, and I think what Clinton did was great when he was in office, and Bush came in, and I think he totally ruined it. That's my personal opinion, I'm not going to change for anybody. This is where I live, and I would like to see my family, my friends, my brothers, my sisters come back from the war. That's where I stand with this whole ordeal. We should have never went to war with them in the first place. And that's it. By the way, my name's Jeremy Elbert. You can find me in Portsmouth. I'm always on a skateboard.
It sounds like you know people who are over there now.
Of course, my family, my brother Mike, my cousin Eric, my sister Lauren, she's over there. My whole family's over there. And I don't like to see them over there, It takes away from my time spending with them. One of them dies, that's going to make me feel really bad because I haven't really spoke to them for a couple of years. They've been over there,
And do you feel like efforts like these folks here are in support of them, or do you feel that it's not supportive of troops for them to do something like this?
I think it's more on the basis this is for the families and the friends of the troops. I mean, you got great people coming out here, volunteers coming out here who don't want to see this go down, and I'm one of those people, I come down here almost every day, chill, relax, help people out, tourists, that's what I like to see. I don't like to see people going over there with guns getting shot. It's not right. Just leave them alone. If they want to be people raising prices on oil, let them do it. We got the money. We're the USA,
Can I say something?
Going over and shooting people to get our people shot is not right.
How about you? Do you have anything you want to add?
I think that this is our world, and this goes for everyone, that we need to stop fighting each other for no reason.
I second that, definitely.
Thanks.
Anytime.
Appreciate it. Here at the July 4th Troops Home Fast action in Portsmouth, we're speaking now with Vivian Bingham and getting her take on why she's come out today. Hi, Vivian.
I've come all the way from Dover, New Hampshire, 12 miles to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And my sign says, Israel-Palestine, the Eye of the Storm. And the reason I brought that sign was I wanted to demonstrate with my sign a connection between the Israel-Palestine dilemma, which has been going on for so long, and the Iraq War, and make that connection.
Can you say a little bit about how you see them connected?
I believe that America's attachment to Israel is not altogether healthy. And I'm afraid that it may have influenced our going to war with Iraq. I don't think we would have gone to a war with Iraq if Israel hadn't wanted it. Let's put it that way. I feel that we are influenced. The Israeli lobby in this country has too much influence in Congress and the Senate, has for quite a while. By whatever means, it appears they have it pretty much their own way. When Sharon invaded the West Bank, Bush said, you've got to get out. And a couple of days later, he said, oh, Sharon's a man of peace, it's okay for him to be there. And I read somewhere that Sharon is supposed to have said to someone, don't worry about the Americans, I've got them wrapped up. I don't know. I don't think that's a very healthy situation for our country to be influenced that much by a little country in the Mideast. And I don't think we should be giving them as much financial and military support as we are. I think we should be more concerned about the Arabs and their feelings. I suppose I could go on and on and on, but that's general idea.
Thanks for telling us.
Okay.
So, Pat, having been here all day, what has the response been like? People coming by and driving by?
For the most part, probably 90% of the responses have been positive, very positive. You know, honking horns, thumbs up, peace signs, people coming up to us and talking to us. We had a history teacher come up to us, and he said that his doctor had fasted for 2 months in protest of the Iraq War back when it first started, which is pretty amazing. And it was amazing that we would meet someone standing out there fasting that knew someone who had done that. But yeah, for the most part, it was a good response, positive response. Unusual for, I thought, for a 4th of July holiday. So it was hopeful.
And I see you have a table with literature. Have you given out a lot of information to people?
Some. Not as much as I would have liked. I think people are sometimes reluctant to come up to a table to take information. But some people who came to talk to us as we were standing there asked for more information about us, and I sent them over to the table.
And what about media coverage?
The media coverage was great. We had someone from Foster's come and interview us, someone from Portsmouth Herald, WMUR-TV, Channel 9 did a segment. Amy Antonucci from WSCA came and interviewed us. I think it was great. I was especially pleased that WMUR came and filmed us. So hopefully that will be on TV and we'll get broader coverage about the issues.
Well, sounds like a successful day, despite the rainstorm even.
Yeah, it was actually beautiful for most of the day. It only started raining later on and after all the media had come and interviewed us, so it was lucky.
Thanks, Pat. Thank you. This is Amy Antonucci with Making Waves. It's 3:20. I'm in Market Square. I've been covering the Troops Home Fast action that SECO's Peace Response has been sponsoring.
That was coverage from this past week's July 4th Troops Home Fast action in Market Square, Portsmouth. We now bring you coverage from the DC version of this same event.
This is Scott Berguin of KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. I've got on the line Meredith Dearborn of Code Pink and Global Exchange. Hello, Meredith.
Hi, Scott. How are you doing?
Great. Very interested in what is happening in Washington, D.C. with this Troops Home Fast.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could give us maybe first a little background for folks that wouldn't know and an update on where we're at right now with the fast.
Sure. Well, on July 3rd, about 150 people sat down in front of the White House to eat their last meal before going on a hunger strike against the war in Iraq. Those people included Cindy Sheehan, the famous peace bomb, Dick Gregory, a legendary Faster, Diane Wilson, environmental activist, Anne Wright, who's a former diplomat and army colonel who actually resigned her post in protest of the war in Iraq. We also had Jeffrey Millard, an Iraq War veteran, and Raed Jarrar, who's an Iraqi blogger. So we had a large representation of people who are going to go on this hunger strike. We also had hundreds of people from around the country, and in fact, we have over 3,000 people signed up from around the country who are going to be going on a fast. So on July 3rd, we sat down to eat our final meal in front of the White House at about 5 p.m. We held a press conference as well, and then at midnight that night, we all stopped eating. So on July 4th, we had our first day without food, and it is ongoing, so people are today on their third day of the fast. We're going to keep it going throughout the summer. Again, those 3,000 people across the country include big names, too. We have Cindy Sheehan, but we also have Susan Sarandon, Sean Penn, Danny Glover, Dolores Huerta, Alice Walker, a really amazing list of people who have decided that this war is so unjust that they need to put their bodies on the line to stop it. And that list, and in fact a lot of pictures and media and a lot more information, is also available on our website, which is troopshomefast.org.
Okay, troopshomefast.org.
Yep.
Okay, that's pretty nice and simple.
Exactly.
Yeah. I love the title, by the way. It's amazing how folks, particularly I know myself and many other people are continually impressed with Code Pink and how and the creativity that's being brought to the fore on this. And I like the thing. I don't know if it was who said this, but something about I think it was something Medea Benjamin wrote about that we've been protesting the war kind of half-heartedly, and it's now time to do it wholeheartedly. I don't know if I'm quoting the right person, but
Well, I believe we've always been wholehearted, and we've always really had the intention to do our very best and work our very hardest to end this unjust, illegal, and immoral war. But we have also exhausted so many, you know, of the usual tactics that we do feel like it's time to do more. I mean, we've marched, we've held vigils, we've held protests, we've infiltrated the RNC, the Republican National Convention. We've infiltrated the Democratic National Convention because both of them at this point are voting for the war. We held a 24-hour vigil on Mother's Day in front of this year, or in front of the White House this year. We brought six Iraqi women to the United States for International Women's Day to lobby Congress in March and speak to the UN. We feel like we've done everything, but now it's time to really get serious and really bring home the suffering and the pain that the Iraqis and the U.S. soldiers are feeling every day. So that's the idea behind really putting our bodies on the line for peace in this way.
Well, you certainly have some people on board who know hunger strikes, some historic events. I mean, Dick Gregory comes to mind, a very experienced hunger striker, Dolores Huerta with the United Farm Workers, Cesar Chavez, of course, who's not with us, but I'm sure he'd be with you. He's certainly there in spirit. Diane Wilson, I was hearing today, the environmental activist, started, she was saying, on a shrimp boat in the Gulf of Mexico along the Texas coast. But obviously there's more than big names involved in this, and a lot of people that are holding it down. At currently, what kind of numbers are you seeing outside the White House? The visible people that are right there on the street.
Sure. Well, on the 4th of July, we had our largest numbers because most people had the day off and actually could come and fast with us in front of the White House. So we had a couple hundred on that day. There will be a constant presence until Camp Casey. That is until Cindy Sheehan goes to Bush's Crawford, Texas ranch. And asks him what noble cause her son died for, as she did last year. She's going to go back.
Right.
So on August 14th, the entire everyone who's right now fasting in front of the White House will actually move to Camp Casey. But currently, we'll have always at least 10 people in front of the White House for the next month.
All right. Okay, and shift gears a little bit here.
Sure.
I'm a kind of an independent media junkie, so I've been seeing this covered in independent media, Democracy Now, as I mentioned before, truthout.org.
Right. Uh-huh.
What is your sense? What kind of calls are you getting from, you know, what we'll call the corporate media or mainstream media?
You know, we've got a great response from both. Obviously, the independent media has been picking up on this, has picked up on it faster and with a more concerted response than the corporate media. We have to do a little bit more work to get their attention. We've had an amazing response, actually. We have... this has been airing on NBC, it's been airing on CNN, on Fox, both news and radio. It's gone over all the wires, AP, Reuters, UPI. It's being, therefore, run in papers both internationally and here at home. We're also getting picked up by the conservative press. Actually, Rush Limbaugh just mentioned us on his show today, which was interesting.
I'm sure it was interesting.
It was definitely not the most complimentary thing.
Right.
But the blogs are going crazy. I mean, we've definitely seen a reaction. I think this has really struck a chord among people across the country. We actually, the last day I was in Washington, I just left last night. We had somebody fly up from Florida who was watching TV and saw it on TV and said, I have to be there. And so he walked on, you know, called up his boss, said, I need to take a couple days off. And he walked out to a plane and showed up at the White House the following day without any resources, without anything. So we've definitely, you know, in terms of media response, I believe that's really what we should be using the media for, is to reach out to people who maybe haven't heard of Code Pink before, or haven't done a hunger strike, or haven't really acted out against the war, who are inspired inspired by this and think that this is something that they can participate in. So with that in mind, we've actually opened this up so people who can't go on a long-term hunger strike can also participate. You can go on a one-day fast, a two-day fast, a rolling fast. You can fast for as long as you can and then pass it on to somebody else in your community to keep it going throughout the summer.
Okay, so are you, you're obviously suggesting that people go to troopshomefast.org.
Uh-huh.
To there you can register to participate in the fast and also give other kinds of support, I'm sure.
Right, and there's also resources there, too, because fasting doesn't do all that much good if you're not visible and people don't know that you're doing it. So there's also resources for reaching out to your local media, pressuring your local representative to sign on to anti-war legislation, and more.
Do you know of other communities where active fasts are happening in a like in a public setting as is happening in Washington, D.C. at this point?
Yeah, well, I am actually, my Google alerts have been going crazy recently on this. I've seen press from Peoria, Illinois, from Portland, Maine. I just got a call this morning from someone in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Apparently people are fasting there. And here in San Francisco, where I am currently, people are fasting in front of Dianne Feinstein's office, pressuring her to sign on for the Harkin bill.
Mm-hmm.
At least those four, and I'm sure there's more. That's just the things that I've been getting press and showing up in my inbox. So, again, Code Pink has over 250 local chapters, and a lot of them have been very activated by this. And a lot of them are also participating in solidarity fasts across the country.
Okay, well, obviously, because it's at the White House, and then we'll move to Camp Casey, the specific focus is in George W. Bush and his administration's direction, but I think also, obviously, you're trying to inspire others in the movement against the war and calling for peace to step up as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is really, you know, I'm going to forget who exactly said this. It was either Diane Wilson or Cindy Sheehan, but talked about how we've done lots of actions to pressure George Bush to do things, and we've done lots of actions to pressure, you know, the peace movement to really galvanize itself and get off its feet, or get on its feet and really start acting against the war, because if we do nothing, then things are going to stay the same, right? But that this is really for ourselves. This is really to prove to we are all dedicated. We don't need any more proof of that, but it's really to bring it home, to bring, again, as I said, to bring the suffering and pain of war home, and to really find out how strong we really are. Gandhi called fasting soul power, and Diane Wilson loves to quote that. She says that, you know, we have people power, we have the power to change Congress and make them sign legislation, but this is power within ourselves.
Right. Well, I think a loose description of what Gandhi stated about nonviolence is that it's a true nonviolent action or force, if you want to call it that. There has to be a sacrificial, self-sacrifice part of it, a toll that the person has to take. That's the true, you know, spiritual depth of it, is that you're actually saying, I'm gonna commit something here to show the strength of what I believe in. So,
exactly.
And this is incredibly impressive, and I do hope we can keep people in touch and talk to folks that are participating and hopefully build a little bit of momentum through radio and the internet here as we go along.
Well, we appreciate your help. We survive through the coverage of radio stations like this one. So.
Yes. Well, I thank you, Meredith, for taking the time. I know you're very busy, and that's the way it should be.
Great.
Hope you keep very busy.
Thank you so much
for interviews and all that. And hopefully we'll talk to you again.
Great.
That was Meredith Dearborn of Code Pink and Global Exchange. If you want more information about the Troops Home Fast or you wish to participate or support them, go to troopshomefast.org.
Oh no, why did we have to go? Bush keeps on lying. Children keep on dying. Get out of it.
That was Get Out of Iraq by The Simple Fears. You're listening to Making Waves. We now bring you this segment about the Rainforest Action Network's Freedom from Oil Action Camp that is going on this coming week.
From July 8th through the 13th in Paoli, Indiana, we're having a Freedom from Oil Action Camp. And we're bringing together people from the Northwest Territories of Canada, the Inuit people, and people impacted by Katrina, and also activists all over the United States and Canada, to start really addressing what we're going to do about our country's oil addiction and the impact it's having on people all over the world.
That was Brianna Kayo Cotter of Rainforest Action Network speaking about the Freedom from Oil Action Camp that is happening next week. Sponsored by the Rainforest Action Network, the Ruckus Society, Global Exchange, and others, this training camp is one of the latest tools that environmental and social justice activists are employing to address U.S. oil consumption. Brianna talks about what activists who attend the camp can expect to learn.
It is a camp that is based in skill sharing, and some of the best trainers in the country will be there. And there will be trainings in direct action, climbing, hanging banners, doing media, creative resistance, and then nightly panels talking about the impacts of oil and kind of envisioning a future without oil and what that will look like.
Niall Malloy, an organizer for Rainforest Action Network, explains the importance of linking oil with environmental justice struggles and how this Freedom from Oil Action Camp aims to address these issues.
And the primary focus is to connect the dots around all the implications of oil, from war to climate change to impacts to frontline communities. A lot of people are really thinking about more creative ways to building coalitions. So in terms of the environmental justice front, from my perspective, we see this as the frontline communities. The communities are directly impacted by climate change, by pollution, by toxins in the community, and from corporations or other agencies and institutions that are just pretty much polluting the area. So we see that it's a mandate from, you know, folks in, that are working on various climate issues and other initiatives, war, anti-war, et cetera, to pretty much try to connect the links to the environmental justice community.
One very concrete example of how U.S. oil dependency affects frontline communities can be seen in the destruction of the Inuit people's land due to petroleum drilling in Alaska and northern Canada. Brianna explains how these stakeholding communities will be represented at the Freedom from Oil Action Camp.
There's going to be youth activists from the Inuit population that are watching literally their homes disappear, melting away. Women in their community can't breastfeed anymore, and they are literally watching their community and their way of life and their land disappear because of Ford continuing to make cars that, you know, guzzle gas at a rate of 19 miles per gallon.
Ford is the target of a large and growing campaign led by Rainforest Action Network and others. Called Jumpstart Ford, the campaign aims to pressure the automaker into focusing on fuel efficiency and developing greener technology.
With the Jumpstart Ford campaign, primarily we're focusing on Ford because Ford has the worst fleet-wide fuel efficiency and the highest average greenhouse gas emissions of all major U.S. automakers. Their overall fuel efficiency average is 19.1 miles per gallon, which is dead last, and is actually less than the Model T over 100 years ago, which actually the Model T got 24 miles per gallon. So what we see is Ford particularly is driving in reverse, and also just most recently, Ford has been investing in, you know, greening, trying to green their logo a little bit. And all this greenwashing is just a joke because yesterday Ford basically backtracked on their commitment of building over 250,000 hybrids. And actually they sort of scrapped that idea and started to think that they will invest in something else. And so we're basically saying that, you know, the Americans and also the rest of the world is tired of Ford and the rest of the auto industry going back and forth on their promises. They should build vehicles that are cleaner, more fuel efficient, and the technology has been there. And we're saying that the technology has been there, and to say that there's not technology available is a sort of like a slap in the face.
In educating the public about the implications of U.S. oil consumption, these campaigns also spotlight oil as a factor in the current Iraq war.
It's undeniable the connection between America's oil addiction and America's quest for oil and dominance overseas. And we have been working very closely with Code Pink, Women Against the War, Iraq Veterans Against the War. We've been doing a series of direct actions at Ford dealerships across the country, and people are locking down in front of Ford dealerships with oil barrels, and on those oil barrels they say, you know, 30,000 plus killed in a war for oil, and then also talk about the amount of oil that Ford cars specifically are guzzling on a single day, which is millions and millions of barrels of oil.
To learn more about the Freedom from Oil Action Camp taking place July 8th to 13th in Paoli, Indiana, visit ran.org. Or to get updates on the Jumpstart Ford campaign, visit jumpstartford.com. For Black Box Radio, I'm Megan Williamson.
I like to drive in America. I like to strive in America. I'm so alive in America, polluting more than Derek and Erica. What would Jesus drive to arrive alive? He'd go 55 in some hybrid jive. 8 feet high, enough to look down on mere mortals driving their mere cars. You may say I'm a dreamer, 'cause I visualize emphysema. Seven suns are swarming, causing global warming, melting polar ice caps, raising oceans, perhaps. But while your fuel-efficient mini car's mired in the mud, my SUV will rise above the flood. I live for the biggest vehicles, spiffy, unsustainable vehicles. Give me the best brand, no generica, though it causes global Guernica. Admittedly, my SUV will cause us all to roast, but it will only take a day to drive from coast to coast.
That was Dave Lippman with SUV Futility Tango. And now for Job Parrish's latest commentary about freedom of medical treatment.
Mom, the criminal.
This is Jaw Parish. On Thursday, June 22nd, 34-year-old Tina Carlson picked up her 9-month-old baby, Riley Rogers, and the pair left Harborview Medical Center in Seattle. It's a perfectly normal scenario, except that Riley was hours away from a scheduled surgery to treat what media reports called a serious kidney ailment. And because Carlson and Riley's father both believe in alternative medical care and had refused doctors' recommendations for surgery and dialysis for Riley, the state of Washington had just taken legal custody of Riley Rogers. Riley himself was not in any imminent danger from his disease, but the parents considered the proposed course of treatment itself to be life-threatening. So when Tina, trying to protect the life of her child against the forcible intervention of doctors in the state, was pulled over by police 48 hours later, Riley was returned to his tiny hospital bed, and Tina is now facing charges of second-degree kidnapping. This story pushed my buttons for several reasons. I've been wrestling with a serious, often life-threatening illness myself for the last 15 years, the result of what media reports might call a serious kidney ailment. I've had the same surgery that was performed on baby Riley a week after he was rescued from his loving mother. Western medicine, the kind Tina Carlson abhors, saved my life. But before it did that, it nearly killed me. I was in a coma 3 times, once for several days. I had nearly a dozen surgeries to fix complications arising from only 15 months of dialysis, the same often debilitating yet life-giving procedure doctors wanted for Riley, and that Tina Carlson was terrified of. The experimental organ transplants that saved my life are a product of cutting-edge Western medicine, yet Western medicine has also blown my diagnoses, given me ineffective treatments for acute problems, and at times made me much, much sicker. It's not an exact science. Neither are the various forms of alternative medicine exact sciences, many of those I've tried. Good naturopaths know when they're in over their heads. I've seen alternative treatments work wonders in grim cases where Western medicine failed badly. I also watched helplessly as a friend with a worrisome lump that was at the time an easily treatable cancer refused for months to go to a doctor due to his hostility to Western medicine. Once it was finally diagnosed, he insisted solely on natural treatments and died a long, slow, agonizing death, wasting away essentially on principle. It was the most pointless, prolonged suicide I've ever seen. For a child, only parents should have the final word on those kind of decisions. Why do members of religious faiths like Jehovah's Witness or Christian Science have the right to refuse recommended medical care for their children, but parents like Tina Carlson are considered criminals for exercising the same right? In our separated church-state legal system, is it really okay for parents to make a counterintuitive medical decision if an amorphous voice in the sky tells them to, but not if they arrive at that conclusion due to research and reason? The state can't claim its religious belief is superior to yours, but it can and does claim that it thinks better than you do? Is that the deal here? I have no idea whether Tina Carlson acted appropriately. I don't know enough about little Riley's medical condition to have a clue. But neither does a judge or the state, one authority figure trusting the word of another. That decision should be solely for Riley's parents, with the aid of medical professionals, Western and otherwise, to resolve. And when a mother feels that the life of her baby is being threatened, my gut instinct is to give her a whole heck of a lot of latitude in what she decides to do about it. Instead, mom was put in jail, possibly facing a year in prison, her life in ruins, the state has taken the kid, apparently indefinitely, and Riley is being subjected to risky medical procedures neither parent wanted. I sure hope this turns out well. KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Jaw Parish.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.